ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। नाम श्रेष्ठं मनमपि शचिपुत्रमात्रस्वरूपं रूपं तस्यागजमुर्भुरिं माथुरीं वैष्णवतीं राधाकुण्डं गिरिवरमहो राधिका माधवाशां प्राप्तो यस्य प्रथितः कृपया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि। वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरो श्रीयतःपदकमलं श्रीगुरुन् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं सागरजातं सहगणरघुनाथन्वितं तं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनसहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपादान् Hare Krishna. Thank you all who come here for this Shravan Kirtan camp. You may wonder why it's called a Shravan Kirtan camp and why not anything else. It could be called festival, sadhu sangha, satsanga. There could be so many names given to it. The general idea is we all come together and do what devotees do, which is principally hearing and chanting about Krishna. If we say sadhu sangha, that's very good. If we say it's a festival or a sammelan, get together, that's also very good. But particularly, I have given this title of a Shravan Kirtan camp, as these are the core activities in Krishna consciousness. If we say a festival, then we might think more about lots of colors, maybe throwing colors around, face painting, and well, on Janmashtami, I walked into a festival which was being organized by some of our devotees, and there were children jumping around on stage to some rock music, and festival is rather vague, and it could comprise of various activities. All which are supposed to be connected to Krishna consciousness. But the core activities are Shravan Kirtan, hearing about Krishna, and speaking about Krishna, singing about Krishna. This, of course, by definition, has to be in the company of devotees. Who else would be interested to do so? Of course, there may be non-devotees who are interested to discuss Krishna in a derogatory or a supposedly scholarly, academic, agnostic manner. But that is not the kind of Shravan Kirtan which is mentioned again and again in Shastra. In Shastra, for instance, in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's the well-known verse, Brahmanda Brahmite Kono Bhagavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Bij, that one among many, many jivas wandering in the universe may by the mercy of Guru and Krishna receive the seed of devotional service. And then what? And then Amali hoya she bij kore aropan shravan kirtan jale kore shechan. The next step is that having got the seed, you have to become a gardener. Not just you get the seed and okay, it's all over. But one has to water the seed with the water of shravan kirtan, hearing and chanting about Krishna. So these processes are recommended again and again. We find in Bhagavatam many, many verses recommending the process of shravan, hearing topics of Krishna, among which the verse which Srila Prabhupada probably quoted the most, I didn't check to count and see, is the Satang Prasangan Mamavirya Samvido Bhavanti Hrit Karna Rasayana Kataha Tajoshana Dashva Pavarga Vartmani Shradharatir Bhaktir Anukramishyati. Lord Kapila Dev says that in the company of devotees, Satang Prasangan, hearing about my glories, in the company of devotees becomes very pleasing to the heart and the ears, and it is discussion which is like a tonic, rasayana. It's also mentioned, rasayana katha. And by such hearing, one advances on the path of liberation and develops in gradually, one after the other, faith, attraction, and devotion. So it's like a rasayana, which means a tonic. Elsewhere, later in the Bhagavatam, Parikshit says, he himself says to Shukadev that this is bhavasu, that it is the medicine for the disease of birth and death. Nivritta tarshaya rupa giyamanad bhavasau dach chotra mano biramat. Same thing, he says that it's very pleasing to hear. But it will be heard by people who are fed up of hearing everything else. When we're fed up of hearing everything else, when we're fed up of all other aspirations, nivritta trishna, when we have no more thirst for anything else, then we can take this medicine for the disease of birth and death. Nivritta tarja bhavoshada chobhata manobhi ramat ka uttama shloka gunana vanat puman virajeta vina pashugnat. Then who will not want to hear such topics? Only the person who is a killer of the self. It means either a butcher, one who is engaged in ghastly material activities, one who is killing the soul. Means also a mayavadi. They may not be interested. So there are many verses which recommend hearing, and of course chanting, kirtan. There are many, many verses which recommend these two processes, hearing and chanting. Shravanadi shuddha chitte kare udoy. By shravanadi, by hearing, shravanam kirtanam vishnu smaran. Shravanadi means all the process of devotional service, beginning with hearing. This causes the heart to become purified. And particularly, among gurus and disciples, guru should speak and disciples should hear. There may be interaction also. It may not just be a one-way flow. It may be as Krishna with Arjuna, there is discussion. Basically, Krishna is speaking. First of all, Arjuna tried to be the guru, but Krishna told Arjuna, "You're a pretty useless guru. You want to instruct me and tell me what's dharma, but actually you're a fool." And then Arjuna said, "Oh, that's right, I should be listening to you. Okay, but anyway, I'm not going to fight, but anyway, I'll listen to you." But there was interaction, and Arjuna, time to time, said, "Krishna, you're not speaking clearly." And Krishna said, "Well, actually, I'm speaking clearly, but you don't understand, that's all. So let's try again." And it went on like this. And eventually Arjuna said, "Ooh, I was in Maya. Now I understand. Thank you. Now I'm free from illusion. Now I understand. Okay, all right, now I'll fight." So there's interaction. This is the Bhagavad Gita is the most famous discussion between guru and disciple in the Vedic corpus. That's the most famous discussion, but it's mostly Krishna is speaking. And same thing, Bhagavatam, Shukadev, mostly Shukadev is speaking. Parikshit also speaks. He also speaks some important statements, just like the verse I mentioned now. But mostly it's Shukadev speaking. And Shukadev speaking is within Sutta speaking to Shaunaka and 59,999 or so other rishis. The most famous is Bhagavad Gita. The most important in terms of the highest discussion is that between Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Ramananda Rai. So these are discussions, but apart from that, there is formal speaking where guru will speak and disciples, basically they will listen without interaction. Nowadays in education, they think it has to be interactive. It's just because people, they watch TV and they play video games and they spend half their life on the internet. So they don't have any attention span. Otherwise, the disciple is meant to just sit and listen. That's all. This is called katha, when there is a speaker, especially when he speaks on some pastimes, that is called katha. And then there's part, which means reading from scripture with interspersing comments. And there might also be sometime some questions or something like this. That's called part. And there's katha. And giving a lecture, vaktritva, just speaking like this. So there are different kinds of speaking. But this is one of the main interactions of gurus with disciples. Now, the way the world is today, mostly, or in many cases, the gurus and disciples, they may not have much personal interaction. That's just an outcome of our very highly mobile society. It has its advantages and its disadvantages. The ideal of a guru living in an ashram with a few disciples who sit around, who live with him and learn from him, we don't see much of that nowadays. But even in traditional societies where there was such a setup, then the gurus may also go out for, mostly if they go out, they go for extended periods, because if you go on a journey means not just hopping on a plane and going somewhere, but you have to walk to go wherever you're going. And it takes quite some time to go and to come back. So we see that the great acharyas, the traditional acharyas who have shaped the life of India's spiritual culture, Shankaracharya and Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, Vallabhacharya, they had their ashrams or their main centers, but they also traveled widely, so both things were there. They would come back to their, well, Vallabh not so much, but Ramanuja and Madhva had their places where they'd come back to, and then they would discourse, or they stayed there, spent time there, and then they'd go out again. And when they stayed in one place, they'd be writing like this. So they'd be traveling and preaching, and they'd stay in one place also, and speaking. Daily function. Srila Prabhupada gave much importance to this, speaking. He would daily speak and disciples would listen. So, nowadays the way things are, there are gurus mostly have disciples spread here and there. That's the way it is in our ISKCON and probably in all kinds of, for want of a better term, Hindu organizations. But this Shravan Kirtan camp, the idea is that instead of myself traveling to so many different places, to come to one place and then the disciples and then others also can come, there doesn't have to be official disciples, those who want to come and listen. And of course there'll be singing, kirtan also, but especially discussion, speaking, because by speaking the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, the guru is supposed to change the outlook of the disciple, to purify, to give the proper concept. That's why we find that our gurus, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, they didn't speak only on pastimes, but they spoke mostly on philosophy, when in their speaking, it's mostly philosophy, so that the hearers could understand their outlook, their understanding of who we are, and what's this world, and why we're living in this world, where we're supposed to be going, that would be clarified. So this is an opportunity for, instead of myself running around here and there and spending so much time running here and there, and then one disciple in this place might get to hear one lecture once a year or something like this, that the disciples can all come together and have some concentrated exposure, association. You can have it also through the internet nowadays, and that's also on the internet and by recorded lectures, and that's also valuable. But there's also some special or some feeling, atmosphere, flavor of devotees physically coming together and hearing and chanting together. So I've been organizing these Shravan Kirtan camps, or organizing means others do the hard work. I come in and talk. But I've been attending and having such programs for quite some years now. I first of all, in Croatia, and that's going on now for about 12 years or something. And in India 2 or 3 times a year. Devotees come from different places, and we have these Shravan Kirtan camps. That's been going on for a few years. And last few years also in Russia. And this year I did for the first time in England, and now for the first time here in America also. And it's also for the disciples, they get to know each other. Because I think here in America especially, most of my disciples, they don't know each other much because they're all spread out here and there. Did you follow up? You had a good idea. You weren't able to do that. All right, that's a suggestion by Krishna Rupa Prabhu here, who most of you probably don't know, and probably most of you don't know each other. At least you could have your name. Everyone could have their name written on a badge. You have a volunteer badge. I don't know if you can get it together for the next 2 days. That would be helpful. At least you could know the name. So that's the idea behind it. And also, in these Shravan Kirtan camps, we usually have some questions and answers session. Our philosophy is that everyone's a person. So although within Srila Prabhupada's movement it's expected that all the gurus basically speak the same thing, because that is the qualification to be a guru in Srila Prabhupada's movement, is to repeat what Prabhupada says. But as we are all individuals, there'll be some personal stance or manner of presentation, and I want to communicate that to my disciples also. Oh, Sri Lanka, we also had Shravan Kirtan camp just 2 months ago, huh? Was it? 3 months ago? June, July, August, September, so about 4 months ago. Where was it? I don't even remember where it was. It was in the hills. In the hills. Yeah, yeah. That's right, yeah. We had a Shravan Kirtan camp. Yourself also, yeah. So, and all the kids came one morning, and then it poured with rain in the house. So Haripada Prabhu with his wife, also present there. And you were there in Udupi also when we were there. Something like that, yeah. We have Vyas Puja, but it's Shravan Kirtan camp all together. It's all together, yeah. So yeah, we just had one in Sri Lanka also. So yeah, I have a specific message which I'd like to communicate also. I mean, I can't say everything all at once, but within our movement there are different perspectives and stances on various issues, and I am not a supporter of the Jato Mot Toto Pot philosophy, which means as you like it. Take whatever you like. Eclecticism. Jato Mot, it means as many opinions, Toto Pot, that many paths. It's Ram Krishna gave this idea. Prabhupada didn't like it at all. So, clear path, let's give a clear path. So, as I said, there could be some questions. So you wrote down, did you write down your question? It was something to do with my taking sannyas, as far as I remember. So we can have that. Oh, please put your name also. If I'll see the... I know who this is from, also nameless. Yeah, phones off, please. Also, Apurva Prabhu has kindly come. I don't know you very much, actually. We didn't meet each other that much. I'm from England, I joined in England, and most of Prabhupada's disciples are from America. And then shortly after joining, I came out to India. And then I was out in Bangladesh, which is like the end of the world. Actually, it's the beginning of the world, literally, because it's the sun rises in the east, and that beyond Bangladesh is the end. It's from the Vedic point of view that the world begins there, begins in Bengal. But from the modern perspective, it's not. It's off the. Well, from the, we were so cut off in Bangladesh, we did. To make a phone call in Calcutta, I remember, we sometimes try to make a local phone call. It's easier to go into the city and meet the person than to call, give them a phone call. So to try to communicate, there was very little communication with the outside world, which was a blessing in disguise in some ways, because they were very turbulent years, the 1980s. So yeah, I was cut off and I didn't get to see. I most of my god brothers and god sisters I don't know, because they're mostly from America. And I was anyway out of orbit, so to speak. So many great souls are serving Prabhupada's missions. It's interesting. Your name is Apurva, because that's, at least in Bengal, that's what people will say after they've taken some prasadam, and they appreciate it very much. They say, Apurva, Apurva, which means never previously. It's better than ever before. So Apurva Prabhu is famous as one of ISKCON's great classic cooks. Saying one of them, because there are others. I recently met Kurma he's ISKCON's most famous cook, because he's done his cooking with Kurma. So I see he's living in Ireland now, for some reason or other. I met him in Ireland. So there are some others also. Sunanda is also a famous cook. In England, this Kulangana Mataji, she's famous. She made the Radha Gokulananda sweets. She's the head of that. She's the founder acharya of that sampradaya. Yeah, she's semi-retired now because she's quite old. She was, but I remember that when I joined, it was at Bhaktivedanta Manor. It was extremely cold. Actually, when I first went to the manor, it was snowing and there was no heating, because George Harrison had given this big mansion, but we didn't have any money to heat it. So it was very cold. And the GBC at that time, with Prabhupada's permission, were giving garlands to the deities, which were mostly leaves, not flowers, just leaves from the garden. It was, and the prasadam was very, very basic. And Mahaprasad, very small plates were offered to Krishna. Then another GBC came in, and he said, "Look, we're going to start feeding Krishna here. That's the first thing we're going to do." And then he got all the devotees inspired to go out and collect to do so, and then things picked up. But anyway, then started offering 100 sweets, big. Before it had been some tiny little sweets, two sweets, and then huge Mangalati offering of all kinds of sweets. So Krishna put on weight and he had to change all the dresses. He visibly put on weight in a short time. Anyway, what was I saying about the great cooks? There's in Mayapur, Didima. She was not so known so much at that time. There's so many. So your name Prabhupada gave you is very fitting for that. Okay, question. This is from Kalki Das. What has it inspired you to take sannyas? And what realizations have you gathered from it? How do you deal with the pulling of the senses? And do you often accept austerities for spiritual realization? If so, what? Also, what is keeping you enlivened in Krishna consciousness? Well, I wasn't really inspired. I didn't have a bolt from the blue once thinking, oh, I got to take sannyas. That can happen. There have been sudden, famous cases of suddenly taking sannyas. Sridhar Swami, the commentator on the Bhagavatam, it's described that his wife died. He was still young and he had a young son. And he thought, well, actually I'd like to take sannyas, but I have to look after this young son. And so he thought, oh, well, all right, I have to look after my son. I can't take sannyas. And then, what was it? He saw some lizard. Yeah, some lizard was just born. And lizard was just born, and some fly was going, and the lizard caught it and ate it. And then from that he had a realization, well, Krishna arranges to look after everyone, even the lizard is just born. So if I leave my son, Krishna will look after him. So he took sannyas. Ramanuja also. Ramanuja Acharya. He was married, young wife, no children as far as we know. But when his wife was insulting to his guru, considering his guru to be low caste and inferior, then Ramanuja thought, just left her, took sannyas. So there may be cases like that. In my own case, I wasn't considering taking sannyas, but Prabhavishnu Swami, he was Swami at the time, who I was serving under, had been serving under for several years, said to me that, he said to me one time, so why don't you take sannyas? I said, well, I thought maybe after I'm 50 I'll take sannyas. He said, no, you can take me. So we discussed it back. It was just out of the blue for me. I suppose he thought about it. Before that also other sannyasis and leaders in our movement had said, why don't you take sannyas? When are you going to take sannyas? When are you going to take sannyas? But anyway, he said it. So he said, okay, we'll put it. I said, okay. He said, well, we can put you on a 5-year list. I said, okay, 5 years. If I took sannyas in 89, so that must have been, I must have been 24 years old at the time. But in those days, yeah, I must have been in the movement for 6 years. But in those days, young sannyas was quite common, was normal, because they're only young men, mostly. And I said, okay, we'll see after 5 years. 5 years seems like quite a long time. 5 years came, it was 1986, it was the most troubled year probably in the history of ISKCON. Big sannyasis were falling down, and I didn't find it was a very auspicious time for accepting sannyas. So it came up, and I thought, no, I'll leave it. I'll just go on. I don't need to take sannyas. I'll just do what I'm doing. So 3 years later, things had settled down somewhat. And I thought that, well, anyway, what I'm doing now, my service is mostly traveling here and there and preaching. So I thought that to officially accept sannyas would facilitate that. So I asked if the, because I was cleared by the GBC to take sannyas in 1986, so I asked, is that still valid? And I said, yeah, you don't need to get cleared again. So then I took in 1989. So what inspired me, it was I just thought it would be more helpful for my service, because I never wanted to get, since joining the movement, I never wanted to get, even before joining, I didn't want to get married, actually. I just thought it's too much, it's more effort than it's worth, too much headache, I thought. Actually, after joining, I saw there's so many grihasthas. So I did think, just shortly after joining, I thought, well, maybe we can have the best of both worlds. So I asked the temple president there in Bhaktivedanta Manor when I joined. I asked him, because he was a grihastha. And I asked him something about, well, is it okay to get married? Or what's the thing, you know? So I see some devotees are married, some are not married. He said, don't get married. It's just not worth it. I said, oh, okay, all right. I thought, he's a senior devotee, he's married, he knows, he should know. And that was it for me. So I didn't contemplate getting married. And so it wasn't, in many ways it wasn't that much of a change, because either internally, but externally there was some change, because people respect you more and this and that. I said it would facilitate my service. Facilitate in what way? People respect you more. Or what do you want that for? Well, if you're going to say something that's worth saying, it's worth creating an sannyas. There's no need to be a devotee. There's, or to try to be a devotee, or to, there's no need. But the need is seen. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted sannyas so that people would take what he said more seriously, and so that they would also, there'd also be some facility and some, people tend to want to help to serve sannyas. You don't want to be served for your own sake, but if you are, for instance, to travel here and there, it does help to have some assistance, and there are others who can, instead of spending half your time arranging your travel, if others want to do that, well, then you can concentrate on the more important things. So, considering that there are some devotees who have experience, who have studied Shastra more than others, and therefore it becomes their duty to try to communicate that to others, and that is most important, then others can assist with that also. And that also facilitates the service. That's, a Vaishnava should not want to be served, but on the other hand, gurus, sannyasis, seniors, they accept service. Why should they do that? Well, as Vaishnavas they shouldn't, but as Vaishnavas they should also, to give others the opportunity to do so. It's a bit of a paradox, as Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, that if a Vaishnava becomes a guru, he ceases to be a Vaishnava. Because a Vaishnava is supposed to be cultivating the mood of being everyone's servant. But on the other hand, if he doesn't become a guru, then the parampara stops. So on the order of his guru, he has to give what he has received to others. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he also accepted sannyas, so his would facilitate delivering what he had to deliver. So that's realizations I have gathered. from sannyas, mostly the realization is I consider myself very fortunate that I didn't have to get waylaid into various activities which are extrinsic to pursuit of the actual goal of life. I can concentrate just on... I don't have to divert my attention into other things. How do you deal with the pulling of the senses? Well, one way to deal with it is just don't deal with it. Just leave it alone. In other words, when we understand that the call of Maya is attractive to the mind and senses, but it's got nothing to do with me. I am not the mind, body, or senses, so what's it got to do with me? It's Aranya Rodana. It's if you hear something in the forest, some creature is calling out. It's a long way away. It's got nothing to do with you, so it's nothing to do with me. The mind has got so many weird things. It's a very strange entity, but it's not me. The polluted mind is not me. So one way to deal with it is just ignore it. That is mentioned also in the sixth canto of Bhagavatam. Srila Prabhupada quoting Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur. So how to overcome lust? Well, it's just like a person who's fasting. On a fasting day, once you decide you're going to fast, if you think, well, maybe I'll fast or maybe I won't, let's see how it goes. Then all the time you're thinking, shall I shanta? I didn't make a... Actually, to observe Ekadashi with fasting, one is supposed to make a sankalpa before you start, a vow, okay, I'm going to fast. And then it becomes much easier, because, you know, well, I'm not going to eat, so that's it. But if you think, well, maybe I will, maybe I won't, and then, and then you collapse, and you... You don't fast. But if you've decided, then you're not interested. It's the same thing. If you decide that I'm only going to take Krishna prasadam, then there may be, in India, in Bengal especially, there are so many sweet shops selling very attractive sweets. In America, there may be so many ice cream shops. In India also, ice cream shops. But if you decided from the beginning that I'm not going to take that, then it doesn't seem attractive, because it's you already decided not to take it. So that's the way to deal with the sense. You decide, okay, that's out of bounds for me. Then the attraction may be there, but if you don't feed it, it doesn't become any stronger. If you don't pour the petrol, gasoline of desire into the fire, then it doesn't flare up. Still, sannyasi has to be careful. Very careful. Especially in dealing with ladies, have to be very careful. Give all respect, but keep a respectful distance also. Which is good advice for everyone, actually, whatever ashram one's in. But especially sannyasis should be very careful in this regard. Do you often accept austerities for spiritual realization? Not much. In terms of extra fasting and things like that, not much, hardly. Just trying to keep the body well enough to go on with service, that's all. As it seems increasingly common in this age, in that just for people to have even basic health is quite unusual nowadays. Whereas even a short time ago, it was quite common that, in India at least, people would follow Ekadashi. Ekadashi is practically, it's almost 3 days fasting if you take the... Well, the day before, one should take, on Dashami, the day before Ekadashi, if one's to actually follow, one should take a light meal at midday, and that's it, finished. And no more water or food until until the time of Paran, which is on Dwadashi. And no sleeping either, many people used to do that, and they'd be going on with their regular activities also. It might be plowing in the fields or whatever. And they didn't find that very difficult, but nowadays, if devotees try to do that, usually their health collapses, either if not immediately after some years. As we often see, devotees, they're very austere for some time, but then their health collapses. So I'm, rather than trying to accept difficult austerities, I'm just trying to keep the body in enough physical health that I can go on with the more important than fasting and all this kind of thing is to go on with Shravanam, Kirtanam. So, what is keeping you enlivened in Krishna consciousness? Krishna consciousness. It is enlivening, isn't it? It is enlivening. It is by its very nature. Krishna consciousness means it's... that means the happiness, haladini shakti, the pleasure potency of Krishna is always with Krishna. So Krishna consciousness is, by its very nature, it's enlivening, gives life to the soul. So by its very nature. And definitely, teachings of Shastra, what Srila Prabhupada has given us, it resonates, it resonates with our understanding. It appeals to our, I just call it Bhavanti Hrit Karana. It gives enlivenment to the Bhavanti Hrit Karana Rasayana Katha. It's so clear and true. And yeah, by nature inspiring. And beautiful the words of Shastra, very beautifully composed. Apart from the teachings, the very sound is uplifting and purifying, poetic. So everything about it is, everything in Krishna consciousness is enlivening. There's great hope. Just like this morning, speaking about Vamana Dev, even though the whole world, everything in it, may be causing us disappointment. But that gives us more incentive to hold on to that which is real, eternal. Whatever difficulties we are experiencing now, and we're all experiencing difficulties because that's the nature of this world, we can always remember everything in this world is temporary. But Krishna is eternal. And I can always link with Krishna at any, all the time. That's all we need to do. We don't need to do anything else. That's eternal. Whatever problems I may have, adhyatmik, adhibhautik, adhidaivik, it will all be finished in a short time. But my relationship with Krishna is eternal. So hold on to that. Hold on to that. If we hear in Bhagavatam, in the ninth canto of Maharaj Raivat, he went up to the planet of Lord Brahma to find a husband for his daughter. And he got a little delayed, and he asked Lord Brahma, and said, "Well, can you recommend someone?" Lord Brahma laughed and said, "All the people you had in mind, they're all dead, forgotten, because time, long before Einstein got the idea, Bhagavatam describes that the time works in a different way on different parts of the universe. So in Brahma's planet, just a few minutes, it's millions of eons on Earth. So all the people you had in mind, they've passed away. Their whole dynasties have passed away. No one's even, not, there's not even any record of their name in history. They're all completely forgotten. So whatever problem I have this terrible pain in my back every night. Or this person is causing me so much headache and so. Just, it'll all be so forgotten that even the biggest person, their name will not be remembered." Just like I term out realizations. Well, I mentioned that in the morning class also. That I saw devotees in Ireland distributing this book, "Chant and Be Happy," with a picture of John Lennon and George Harrison on the covers. I asked, "Do the young people nowadays, have they heard of John Lennon and George Harrison?" He said, "Yeah, most of them have heard of John Lennon, not so much George Harrison. But it doesn't mean anything to them, very special." But it was such a big thing at the time. Such a big person. John Lennon. Oh, already forgotten. On the way to being forgotten. So, what to speak of us? We're very small people. We all take ourselves far too seriously. I remember before I joined the movement, I was in England, somewhere, I was in some second-hand bookshop, and I saw some big fat book. And the title of the book, it was an old book, must have been from the early 20th century. The title of the book was "My Philosophy." And then I can't remember the name of the person. I never heard of him before. I don't think anyone else had ever heard of him. And he had a book called "My Philosophy." I said, why on earth should we take this person seriously? What his philosophy? Sometimes people say to you, "Well, there's no God. I don't believe in God." So what's your name? So-and-so. "Announce, so-and-so has said there is no God. Everybody take note. There is no God, according to some." Who cares for him? John Lennon. "I don't believe in Krishna." Do, 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 do. Believe or not believe. He thought it was very important to announce to the world everything he doesn't believe in. And many people took him seriously. Just another fool. So many fools. "I'm just John, that's all." But he's not John anymore. He's maybe a worm in some John's stool. Someone else with the name John. It's pathetic. It's pathetic how seriously we take ourselves. So, Bhagavad Gita is very enlivening. Constant source of enlivenment. Should devotees go to programs or associate with other Gaudiya Math devotees, Krishna Rupa Das. It's always a difficult one, isn't it, this one? Because, well, we all like devotees, don't we? On principle, there shouldn't be any problem, but in practice, there often is. In practice, there often is means that often we find that, not in all cases, but often we find that Gaudiya Math devotees, they have a policy of becoming friendly with ISKCON devotees, and then they get to know all the newcomers, and then they, when their guru comes, they take them to their guru and give them on-the-spot initiation, which doesn't help the newcomers in most cases, because they're not really ready for... The level of commitment is not very high, and it's just seems to be increasing the their numbers. So that is a problem. And often they have the idea that, well, if you come to us, we've got the real thing, and ISKCON is just all neophyte and this and that. So, that's Krishna Rupa in Alachua, when Alachua is a real smorgasbord. It's a real mix-up, everything. Every kind of ISKCON, Gaudiya Math, Ritvik, everything's there. But Gaudiya Math people don't come to our programs only if there's some big festival. They don't come only to try to take people away, is what I see, isn't it? So why should we go to their program? They call us to their program because they want to take us away, isn't it? It's generally with an agenda, isn't it? Sorry to say. Although I also know devotees who are in Gaudiya Math and friends and this and that, but I don't, as a general policy, mix up. Friends means I know devotees from before. They were in ISKCON, initiated by one guru, initiated by another guru, initiated by another guru, and then they went to Gaudiya Math, and there's an elderly sadhu who they, at least they can trust, wouldn't fall down, so you can understand that. So, we can be respectful, friendly, but we may not want to mix up. And there's a different atmosphere and feeling also, isn't it? Because in ISKCON, we're supposed to be focused on Srila Prabhupada. So there is a difference. On the other hand, I may not wish to, within ISKCON there are different flavors also, and I personally I'm not much attracted to interact with various different flavors. Like I said, on Janmashtami, on Janmashtami this year I went to different places in England, because it's a small country, so you can, in one day, starting from early morning till up at midnight at night, you can visit various cities. It's within 4 hours you can cover most of the main population centers of England within 4 hours driving. So yeah, the second place I went to, I walked in and there was some rock music going on. So that's quite common in ISKCON programs, from what I understand, but personally I have no attraction to that. So you may want to choose your association within ISKCON also, for instance. Okay, a question from Naimish Aranya Das. From your running class lecture, Oops, there's something. Fell down here. From your morning class lecture, in order to create a systematic study of philosophy, how can we prepare ourselves to do this service? Oh, yeah, in the morning I spoke about how, as I see it, there is a need to present the philosophy, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings, as received through our acharyas, in a manner, dialectic spiritualism. there is that book which came out, Srila Prabhupada, Dialectic Spiritualism. In a manner in which we take the issues which Western philosophy is seized of and present those with the Gaudiya Siddhanta. And the first major stumbling block, which is a major stumbling block because it defines, or philosophical difficulty or question to be addressed, is the whole definition of philosophy, beginning with epistemology, or what do we consider to be accepted as knowledge. Difficulties with that. I spoke about that in the morning. One difficulty is that in Western philosophy, actually these terms, Western philosophy, Indian philosophy, they're not. And here we come to philosophy of language, because philosophy, there's philosophy of language, philosophy of law, philosophy of science, and there are so many different branches. Philosophy of history, philosophy of politics, and on and on and on. So the philosophy, it's, when we say Western philosophy, but if philosophy is concerned with issues which transcend geographical limitations, but practically speaking, we speak of Western philosophy because of the historical background, the history of ideas. That's another field of study, the whole how ideas have evolved. So Western philosophy is on the basis of, we're here, are we? That's questionable also. Everything's up to question, and we're here, and well, what's going on? Beginning from that. Whereas Vedic philosophy begins with the idea that there is knowledge, Veda, which is independent of our perception or our ability to understand it. That is knowledge, and that is what we have to understand. And in Vedanta, which Vedic philosophy doesn't mean only Vedanta. Vedanta is only one school. Although it's actually Vedic knowledge is Vedanta, but in terms of Vedic philosophy, there are various schools. So Vedanta accepts as an opening axiom that there is Brahman, that there is supreme reality, which is the substratum of everything. So inquiry into Brahman is our beginning. How we inquire. Well, that's through the Vedic knowledge. So it's revealed knowledge, which from the outset Western philosophy rejects. So that's a major, and our system is we receive through Acharya Parampara. They reject that. Everything is up to question. And in the Vedic system, there is the idea of certainty, certain knowledge. Asangshayang samagram, Krishna tells Arjuna. You can know everything totally free from doubt by hearing from me. So that idea. But in Western philosophy, that idea is outdated or outmoded, and the idea is that we can't understand everything. That there's no such thing as completely fixed knowledge. So these are the kind of questions that arise in philosophy. Subjectivity versus relativity. Subjectivity and objectivity. But I believe we can tackle this with the Chintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, because everything, there is certainty and there is non-certainty also. And the achintya bheda bheda, this applies in every area. So that we have something like that in modern quantum theory, and that has had an effect on philosophy overall. That what is observed depends a lot on the observer. So there are many intricate questions which face Western philosophy, and I believe we can tackle them. But it has to be done in such a way that it's not rejected outright. If we just come and say, well, this is Vedic philosophy, but we have to. Just like Satsarupa Maharaj made this book on Srila Prabhupada's order, he made this book called Readings in Vedic Literature. And he presented it quoting all kinds of mundane scholars. And so it's acceptable for use in the universities. Srila Prabhupada wrote him a letter congratulating him. He said that I'm paraphrasing here, I don't remember exactly, that you have quoted all these people, but you haven't been diverted by them. Because you can find, many people say things which are true, but if you take their whole philosophy, they'll have many flaws in it also, but you may take things out of it which are acceptable. So what to do to prepare yourself? Well, first thing to do would be to read Srila Prabhupada's books several times, all of them. Do a lot of chanting. Prerequisite would be a deep interest in philosophy and an understanding of why we want and need to present this to the world. Actually, it's not to the world, it's for a very few people. Just like Jiva Goswami's writings. It's not, even among Gauriyas, it's never been something which is widely studied. It's for a few. But it's important because the few are influential. How many people have read Karl Marx's works? I'm not asking you, I'm just saying in general. One person who read it was Nikolai Lenin. He took it seriously. Had a major influence on the whole 20th century. Well, starting from a little bit into the 20th century. So, yeah. So it would require a lot of study, philosophical outlook. And the first thing would be to be very fixed in understanding what Srila Prabhupada has given, which is the quintessence of Gauriya Vaishnava philosophy. and also the issues which he addresses and the issues which are out there in the world and in the world of philosophy. There are all kinds of philosophical issues which philosophers debate among themselves. And there always have been, and among Vedic philosophers there always have been also. So we have to identify the most important ones. And it's an ongoing thing. If we, in this generation, if we do something, and then there'll be, that's the way it is in Vedic philosophy also. Then others will, someone else will come up with a rebuttal, and then, just like Shankara gave his philosophy, Shankaracharya, then the Vaishnavas rebutted it, and then in writing, and in verbal debate, and then from the other, then the Mayavadis go back and they think about it and they come back again with a reply to the rebuttal, and it goes back and forward like this. And even within the different schools, within Shankara's Sampradaya, someone will say, well, actually this is the way Shankara said this and this is the way it's understood. And then someone else within, they say, no, it's not like that. And within the Sampradaya there are various branches. So that's going on. That will go on. Within our own Sampradaya, I was speaking of Jiva Goswami. He appeared to support the Svakiyavad, that Krishna is actually married with the gopis. But Vishwanath Chakravarti gave the present course of our Gaudiya Sampradaya is well, it's based on the level of what is our prayojana, what is our highest aim. That's based not on what Jiva Goswami explicitly said, but on what Vishwanath said. Because Vishwanath Chakravarti upheld parakiya rasa. The highest is understanding the same pastimes described in Srimad Bhagavatam, but understanding then that Krishna is with the wives of others, or that's the feeling. But Jiva Goswami supports the Svakiya rasa. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur discusses that. So, it's a... And then you get people like Kabir come and say, what are you discussing all these things for anyway? Just don't waste your time. Just see God everywhere and see God in everything. So it's a world of we live in a world of ideas, and ideas have, there's a book written shortly after the Second World War, I believe, called Ideas Have Consequences. It's an interesting title, huh? Ideas Have Consequences. People fight over land, money, oil, power, women, but they also fight over ideas, isn't it? That's why Lenin, he took up Marx's idea. Marx's idea is that there should be constant struggle, war, revolution. So people fight over ideas. Fighting now in the Middle East, the Shia versus Sunni. It's over ideology. Within our ISKCON also, we're not bombing others, and I hope it never comes to that. You never know. It could do. The history of Europe is one of fighting, a lot of it religious. But that will go on. So, and at the present time, we have ideological discussion, polemics within ISKCON. But we don't even have a system of discussion. There are no ground rules. We're so far away from any actual philosophical culture that we don't have any ground rules of discussion. What is the basis on which we're discussing? Someone will quote Prabhupada and they say, yeah, Prabhupada said that, but I was with him personally, and then we have to see what is stronger evidence, what Prabhupada said or what he did, if there appears to be a difference. Then it may come to interpretation, where, just like it said that, well, in the beginning, men and women are all the same in ISKCON, and we all mixed up together, and we all danced together in Kirtan, but then these nasty sannyasis stopped all that, and Prabhupada didn't say anything because he didn't want to upset the sannyasis. There's a paper written like that in the year 2000, which ideas have consequences. It influenced GBC legislation and outlook. But that's an interpretation of why Prabhupada went along with this. And my understanding is that actually Prabhupada, in the beginning, he didn't, and he himself quoted this Kenap, Tasmat Kenap Yupayena Manah Krishna Nishevayat Sarva Vidhi Niseda Sya Etaya Eva Kinkaraha. The first two lines of this verse are from Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th canto. The last two lines are from Padma Purana, from another verse. And they're both quoted in the second chapter of the first division of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, but in separate verses, but Prabhupada put them together. And the first two lines, Tasmat Kenapyupayana, by any means, the mind should be brought to Krishna. The mind should be brought. And then, Sarva Vidhi Nishedasya Etayor Eva Kinkraha. This, actually, the first two lines of this verse from the Padma Purana are Smartavya Satatang Vishnu, Vismartavya Najatu Chit. One should always think of Krishna, Vishnu, and never forget him. And then, all the rules and regulations in Shastra, they are servants of this rule and regulation. So Srila Prabhupada, he explained that in the beginning you somehow or other bring people to Krishna consciousness, and later on you introduce the rules and regulations. So in the beginning Srila Prabhupada did the impossible, what was considered impossible, of bringing sensuous young Americans into Krishna consciousness. I was just discussing this with Mahatattva Prabhu last night, as he was discussing with me how he felt it's very difficult to train Americans, people from an American cultural background, in commitment and dedication, discipline, and all these things. And then I said to him, it was just amazing how Srila Prabhupada engaged so many different people of so many different backgrounds and in Americans, and engaged them in Krishna consciousness. And some you could understand more, like Tamal Krishna Maharaj, whose presence is felt here even after so many years. Although I suspect it would be more of what do they call that? A smart ship? Ship shape, if he was here. What do you call that? Smartly run ship. What's that? Anyway, if he was here, it'd be more strict. Tight ship. Yeah, that's it. But in some sense, you can understand, because he himself was a very disciplined kind of person, and a person who was inclined to discipline others. So you can understand. But on the other hand, he was very headstrong. Harikesh, also disciplined, but very... But when you think of those who came from more hippie-like background, and how Srila Prabhupada got them disciplined, it's just amazing. But somehow or other, Prabhupada did it. So Srila Prabhupada, in the beginning, he was very liberal, but gradually he also, I was discussing with Mahatapa Prabhu last night, that in the beginning, Srila Prabhupada, he gave kirtan, prasadam, and philosophy, and he didn't compromise the philosophy when he was speaking. But he encouraged people to come, but he gave the clear philosophy right from the very beginning. Even in the 1966, he was talking about Varnashram and his, like, you can hear, the lectures are recorded. Varnashram and giving up sensual desire, sexual, free sex. His followers were coming. Well, they weren't really followers because they didn't believe in following. They didn't have any idea. They didn't have any culture of guru and disciple, which in India that culture has been there for thousands of years. You get some young boy, he'll go in the ashram of a guru and he'll just serve him day and night. That was the culture. They didn't really even think about it. That's just what you do. That's how a disciple serves a guru. They don't think, well, what I have to do and my own needs and my own emotional needs. And they're just, okay, I'm a disciple, so you serve. And when it's hot, you fan the guru. Okay, well, in the summer it's hot 24 hours a day. That means probably you don't sleep. Stay up all night. Finding the guru, that isn't just done. You don't think about it. This modern civilization is just diametrically opposite to that. So yeah, Srila Prabhupada gave the philosophy, but he didn't really have followers. There were people who came around, and if they felt like it, they might do a little service or something. Maybe. Prabhupada would do all the cooking, and Brahmananda gave him some. Well, that was a little later, gave him responsibility and so on. But then Prabhupada had they weren't really going anywhere. They just came in and they're, you know, Swamiji, and it's, you know, we go and we listen and we go and we still have our Ramakrishna and Aurobindo and Lao Tzu, and it's all mixed up, and yeah, Swamiji's great. And Prabhupada at one point just completely verbally smashed them very heavily, very angrily. And I noted this in this book on speaking strongly in Srila Prabhupada's service, this incident where Prabhupada just smashed them and very, very heavy on their Mayavad, which they were completely into, even after months of hearing Prabhupada. And Prabhupada just wanted to expurge it from them. And very likely they could have all just gone away. Prabhupada was very, very heavy with them. And in their idea, a sadhu is one who holds a flower and smiles, like Maharishi Mahesh Yogi at that time was very popular. He holds a flower, has a beard, and he smiles. And that's what a sadhu does. Prabhupada is very, very heavy. Could have lost them all, but he didn't want to tolerate that nonsense in them. And they came around. And then Prabhupada had they weren't committing. Then Prabhupada said, okay, and we're going to have an initiation ceremony. They didn't know what it meant. The next day, Prabhupada gave a list, initiated devotees. They must attend all the programs. They must chant at least 16 rounds. They must take no food cooked by non-devotees. He didn't tell them before initiation. He told them after initiation. They weren't moving, and Prabhupada wanted, he kick-started them and brought them up to that level. Then San Francisco is all flower power, and if you ever go to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair and all this useless sentimentalism and all this and that. So Prabhupada was very accommodating, and he initiated very widely, but eventually he introduced the morning program. There was no morning program. There were initiated devotees living in the temple, but there was no morning program. And devotees would go out late at night in Los Angeles to Hollywood Boulevard every night, come back 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, get up whenever they wanted to. There was no morning program. Then Prabhupada just introduced, okay, 4:30 in the morning. Mangalarti. That was the end of the late night every night. Sankirtan, which was actually in many ways generating a lot of interest and this and that. And then Prabhupada introduced 4:30, and then morning class every morning, which all the devotees have to attend. That wasn't there. He gradually introduced all these things. So the idea that, well, in the beginning it was all just love and everyone was all mixed. Yeah, the first deities, they were the Jagannath. They were carved by Shama Sundara. Prabhupada came in one time while they're being carved and knocked the, there were 1, 2, 3 deities, and Prabhupada knocked the cigarette packet which Shama Sundara already initiated was smoking in between while he was carving the deities. And the original deity worship was just the deities are there, and there's a plate with a lamp on it, and the devotees take turns in offering the lamp. That was the deity worship. So gradually Prabhupada introduced in standards. He wrote about it in his books. Devotees went to India. They saw these things. They wanted to institute it. There were devotees like Tamal Krishna Maharaj who were interested in introducing some disciplines so as to be more effective in everything, in preaching, in our own personal life. But there are some devotees who think, well, Prabhupada at that time, you see, was so open with us, and that was the real thing. Well, it would be the real thing if we were all Paramahamsas, but we're not. Some rules and regulations are required. So how did I get to talk about this? Where am I heading to now? You can't change the culture all at once. Yeah. So yeah, ideas have consequences. Yeah. So Prabhupada did tighten up, and based on Shastra, based on understanding the Shastra psychology, discipline is required. Our prayojan is not discipline, but our abhideya requires it. Our ultimate goal is to dance in... Well, actually our ultimate goal is to serve Krishna as he wants, but that means dancing in the fields with Krishna, either as a gopi or a gopa, or one may be a blade of grass, happy enough to get the dust of those who are dancing on your head. But discipline is required. And discipline, when there's a question of discipline, then there's a possibility of misuse, exploitation. This is the point I was making. There are different ideas of what Prabhupada said. Prabhupada said this, but he did this. So which is Prabhupada in his writings again and again, you'll find that Prabhupada said all women should be addressed as mother. But it seems in the early days of the movement, he also said Prabhu. Later, not at all. But in the early days, he also said. But I wouldn't take the early days as the standard. Because in the early days, Prabhupada was just giving, I mean, not even practically ABC, prior to ABC. But you see, there are different interpretations, and that causes divisions. So what is the proper philosophical understanding? We have to come to that. How to prepare ourselves, practice Krishna consciousness very properly, study Prabhupada's books. And yeah, I'm giving this whole talk about this to understand why understanding is important. Why philosophical understanding is important. Why did Srila Prabhupada literally day and night speak philosophy? Literally. Is it not? Even all day he'd give classes. When he'd meet with devotees, he'd speak philosophically. When he met with press people, he'd speak to them the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. And at night, he would go on dictating for his books. Why? Why so much emphasis? Why not just chant Hare Krishna and let's all just love each other? Because we need to understand this philosophy. So how to prepare ourselves for this? Um, Well, if I think I'm about myself, why I'm interested in this? Because I see a need for it. When we see the need for it, then we'll follow it. If we see how the world is misled by so many wrong ideas, then we want to give the right idea. But if we see the wrong ideas, we have to dig deeper. Where do they come from? As this morning I was quoting from the Kali Yuga Acharya, John Lennon. But where do his ideas come from? It's not that he may have thought, actually he thought he was a genius. That's the problem with a lot of people. They think they're a genius. No, he actually said that. He said that. Well, I always thought I was a genius, but why don't people recognize me? So he got recognized. Recognized enough that someone wanted to kill him. And did kill him. So, but probably he didn't realize that his ideas, it's not that they just popped into his mind. But there's a whole background influencing us. Why is America the way it is today, and it's not, the culture here is markedly different to that of, for instance, India, or even more so, Iran? Of course, it's a very broad thing to speak about American culture, because it's not monolithic, nor is Iran for that matter. But they're very great. Well, there's clearly an ideological difference between the predominant culture in Iran and that in America. In Iran, it's that of Islam, Shia Islam, which has its distinct differences from that of Sunni Islam. In America, it's difficult to say, because there are two major cultural trends here. One is Christian and the other is liberal humanism, and they're not mutually exclusive. So we're really talking about, it all becomes quite complex. But there are people who work on this. There are what we can say are professional philosophers, and they do influence others. In the modern age, feminism, for instance, has been very influential in shaping the way attitudes in society, and ideas have consequences. Ideas have consequences. The idea that it's okay to be a homosexual was not a common idea, and even homosexuals, they themselves didn't believe it. They didn't think it was good. But that was promoted, and now it's accepted largely in America, even by many Christians who their grandfathers wouldn't have accepted that at all. So that idea where has that idea come? Well, it's based on the idea that, well, you only live once, and you are what you are, which they don't, in terms of their body and their mind. And so we should be free to pursue. In America, the underlying idea is that everyone should be free to pursue personal happiness to the fullest extent. Moral relativism, yeah. There's no fixed morality. Well, we do agree with that in practice to some extent, but the underlying morality is Krishnarthe Akhila Cheshta. Everything should be done for the satisfaction of Krishna. And what is that? That's described in Shastra. But sometimes to satisfy Krishna, you may have to go against Shastra. Or Krishna might actually be more pleased if you do go against Shastra. In some instances. For instance, the cowherd boys, they're eating what their mother has given them. They all have their own individual tiffin. And someone's eating, oh, this is so nice. Here, Krishna, you taste it. Because they think Krishna will like to taste it also. You don't do that. The pujari comes from the kitchen carrying the food, tastes a bit and says, "Hey, Krishna, take it." No, no way. That's a great aparad. But at a certain level, you can do that. So all these questions should be... There is some relativity also. The absolute center is Krishna, what he wants. And generally that is understood through Shastra, but it's not only Shastra. There's also Guru Sadhu, the example of Guru Sadhu. It becomes quite complex. And that's one reason why we need in every generation acharyas. You see, there's this Ritvik movement now. They say Prabhupada's the last acharya. But they also, what do they do? Say they among themselves, if they have some issue about, well, do we have women, devotees in the body of women? Should they also be temple presidents, leading kirtan? They also will have the same issues. Then so they'll have to interpret also. And someone, and then, not that everyone's going to sit down and individually work it out. Someone has to take the lead, write a paper and this and that. So someone has to act as an interpreter of Guru, Sadhu and Shastra. And the Vedic system is, you accept an acharya and accept his guidance, because it's not that everyone can work. Like Jiva Goswami sat down and he worked through all the major philosophical issues of the day as seen through Srimad Bhagavatam. It's not that everyone does, not even that every acharya does that. It would be better if they did, but it's not that everyone does. But it's not that everyone can deal with every single philosophical issue. So to a large extent, we accept what our acharya gives us. And we try to understand also, which is why we have discussions like this. But we also try to understand, not just blindly, just like this issue. Did we fall down from the spiritual world, or were we just popped out of the Brahma Jyoti, or the fall of the Jiva issue? I don't know. the core statement in Chaitanya Charitamrita has an inbuilt, if you take the language as it is, there's an inbuilt contradiction. Krishna Bhuli Sai Jivan Adi Bahimukh. Krishna Bhuli, forgetting Krishna, the Jiva is since time immemorial inimical. So the forgetting means there's some certain point in time. It suggests that. Whereas an adi says it's beginningless. And then you have to, interpret. Well, is the word bhuli, is that to be taken out of its normal context, to be understood contextual, or is the word an adi to be understood? One of them is not, the two words can't sit together if they're taken in the usual literal meaning. And so the discussion goes on and on and on. And then I was just told yesterday, someone has written a book, and Richie says he's sold it. It's clear. And it's irrefutable. Yeah, both sides say that. The fall and the no-fall bodies. But anyway, what I see that Srila Prabhupada was, whenever he was asked about this, he explained in detail. First of all, he said, don't bother about it too much, because you can't... The main thing is to get out of this dump. Go back home, back to Godhead. But he would explain that it's our misuse of... he said we were with Krishna. Okay, I accept that. He's my acharya, I accept that. And it's not... And if we see the writings of previous acharyas, they also say that. And Prabhupada also quotes, Jiva Goswami also says, no one ever falls from the spiritual world. How is it to be... harmonized. You can go in, you can go on and on and on, and it will go on and on. Probably this discussion will go on and on and on for generations. But then on the other hand, we also have, the Prabhupada said, which is also Ramanuja said, many of the, you see, Prabhupada's an acharya. What does that mean? He follows the previous acharyas. So if someone... Someone said to me recently, he'd been reading the writings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He said, I see, oh, Prabhupada, everything he said, it's just he's taking it from Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I said, yeah, of course, that's the system. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he also took it from the previous acharyas. That's the system. He made some amazing discovery that Prabhupada's following Bhaktivinoda Thakur. But Prabhupada himself, he always said that what is an acharya? He follows the previous acharya. So it shouldn't be an amazing discovery. We might think that Prabhupada, he came and he just, everything he said, he just made it up as he went along. It's not like that at all. So we can't study it's not possible for people, especially in the modern age, to understand every issue in great detail with all the arguments back and forth which have ever been made. It's not possible. It may not be necessary also. There may be specialists in various fields, but it does matter. Oh, about the jiva fall down issue, the main point that Prabhupada always emphasizes is that we have our own independence, which we have misused. That's the important point. Purusha sukha dukkha nam bhuktritve hetu ruchyate, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. We in the material world are trying to be the enjoyers, but we are the cause of our own happiness and distress in this material world. It's right there in Bhagavad Gita. But also we have in the same chapter, Purusha Prakriti Stohi Bhunkte Prakriti Jangunan Karnam Guna Sangos Sada Sadhyoni Janmasu. We're Purusha, we've taken the position of the enjoyer. These words, Purusha and Prakriti, very important words in Vedic dialogue. They have, apart from the use in Bhagavad Gita, they have a whole history, philosophical history behind them. So anyway, here we are stuck in this material nature, which is made of three modes of material nature, and we have happiness and distress according to our association with those modes of nature. So, I mean, even Bhagavad Gita, it's a great ocean condensed into short summary, but it's a whole ocean of Vedic philosophy and dialogue. It's all there. And it's a huge subject, which I think there are a few good scholars still in India, but I think they would be the first ones to admit that they've hardly touched the surface of it all. But we have to present that in a way that will influence the way of thought. We need a paradigm shift. Western philosophy is stuck. Science is stuck for almost 100 years now. They're not going anywhere. There's so many problems. Philosophical problems. Problems in science. Our devotees should be leading the way out of the morass. Both philosophically, practically, Prabhupada wanted to make leaders of society, isn't it? By their character, showing a better way of life. If we'd actually done what Srila Prabhupada said and made farm communities simple living and high thinking, think it would be popular today? Think it would be popular? It would be wildly popular. Living simply, producing our own food. It would be a massive success. It would be a template for others to follow. But people don't take us seriously. They take the Dalai Lama seriously. Well, what he says appeals to them, because there's no demand. It's, you can take it and adjust it to your own needs. Or he administers to the dream. We're in a dream world. And all these Sri Sri and all this kind of people, they all administer to, it's administering to the dream. It's not for breaking us out of the dream. Prabhupada was different. So how to prepare ourselves for this? Well, if you have a... first of all, if we see what the problem is and think how to address it, that's the beginning. There is... At the basis of this whole horrible civilization. Horrible means the way it completely mangles people's spiritual aspirations. They have no hope. Even Prabhupada said the educational institutions are the slaughterhouses, but I think that statement is anachronistic. It's out of date, because even before they get to the school, they're slaughtered already. Even in the womb. Their spiritual aspiration is complete. The whole culture is so bad. So very, very bad. Catering to the dream. The dream that we shall be happy in this world. So, if we see the need for that, then if we're driven by that, you have to be driven. It's not just a matter of... it's not just a matter of... maybe taking some course, Bhakti Shastri course, Bhakti Vaibhava. There has to be some drive. I really want that question. What was that question? Where do you get your inspiration? What's keeping you enlivened in Krishna consciousness? Well, the drive. We have something. What Prabhupada has given us. We have to communicate that to others. We have to try to help others get that. And it's not that just we're preaching and Jehovah's Witnesses are preaching and the Greens are preaching and vegans are preaching and we're all trying to increase our numbers. It's nothing like that. We want to communicate. We have something vital to communicate, which is completely different from all the... It's all people babbling within their dreams. So if you're driven by that, then you'll have to. There's no question. You'll have to. You won't be able to sleep at night. Put it like that. If you wake up in the night thinking about these things, then you can do it. If it's just something you're thinking on the side, then it's not going to happen. Oh, the aarti is at 6:30. It's already halfway through. That's supposed to be a break for the aarti, isn't it? Should we take a break then? We can all at least go to the end. Maybe you should tell me if I'm going over time so we can go for the aarti. This is also important. These discussions.